Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verse 10. Whatever exists has already been named, and what humanity is has been known. No one can contend with someone who is stronger. The more the words, the less the meaning. And how does that profit anyone? For who knows what is good for a person in life during the few and meaningless days they pass through like a shadow? Who can tell them what will happen under the sun after they are gone? A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, for death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. Frustration is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. It is better to heed the rebuke of a wise person than to listen to the song of fools. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless. Extortion turns a wise person into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the heart. The end of a matter is better than its beginning, and patience is better than pride. Do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools. Do not say, "Why were the old days better than these?" For it is not wise to ask such questions. Wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing and benefits those who see the sun. Wisdom is a shelter, as money is a shelter. But the advantage of knowledge is this: wisdom preserves those who have it. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider this: God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, no one can discover anything about their future. In this meaningless life of mine, I have seen both of these things: the righteous perishing in their righteousness, and the wicked living long in their wickedness. Do not be overrighteous, neither be overwise. Why destroy yourself? Do not be over wicked, and do not be a fool. Why die before your time? It is good to grasp the one and not let go of the other. Whoever fears God will avoid all extremes. Wisdom makes one wise person more powerful than 10 rulers in a city. Indeed, there is no one on earth who is righteous. No one does what is right and never sins. Do not pay attention to every word people say, or you may hear your servant cursing you. For you know in your heart that many times you yourself have cursed others. All this I tested by wisdom, and I said, "I am determined to be wise." But this was beyond me. Whatever exists is far off and most profound. Who can discover it? So I turned my mind to understand, to investigate and to search out wisdom and the scheme of things, and to understand the stupidity of wickedness and the madness of folly. I find more bitter than death the woman who is a snare, whose heart is a trap and whose hands are chains. The man who pleases God will escape her, but the sinner she will ensnare. Look, says the teacher, this is what I have discovered. Adding one thing to another to discover the scheme of things, while I was still searching but not finding, I found one upright man among 1,000, but not one upright woman among them all. This only have I found: God created mankind upright, but they have gone in search of many schemes.
There's lots in those words to think about. Let me lead us in prayer, and then we'll think about them together. Our Father, please teach us wisdom this morning from your word. Please, Father, would these words change us? Would they help us to follow you this week? Amen. Every one of us is seeking the good life. You can see that in all kinds of ways. So, for example, if you go online and look up the 10 most popular TED Talks that have ever been done, I don't know if you're a TED Talk fan, kind of these 15-minute kind of talks with experts coming to talk about their specialism for a few minutes. If you look at the 10 most popular, two of the top 10 are on this question, how to live a good life, how to make the most of life. Of those two, the most popular, over 50 million views, a 15-minute talk entitled, What Makes a Good Life? It's a question that all of us ask in different ways. If you're here and you're a Christian, you're trying to work out what is it like to live a good life that follows the Lord. If you're here and you're maybe looking into these things, you're thinking, maybe Jesus offers me a better life than I've currently got. And that's part of what you're weighing up, and that's part of why you're here this morning. We're all trying to answer that question, what makes a good life? And that's not a new question. The book we're reading is 2,500 years old. And it is trying to basically answer the same question. You see it there in chapter 6, verse 12. Who knows what is good for a person in life? During the few and meaningless days, they pass through like a shadow. What makes a good life, asks our teacher. The one who wrote this book, the teacher, he gives a surprising answer to us. If you're kind of dropping in partway through the series and you're feeling slightly disorientated, let me help orientate you to Ecclesiastes for a few moments. It's written, we don't quite know exactly who by. It's a few different options, but we know that this person tried everything the world had to offer. And as he tried everything the world had to offer, they all came up empty. There was nothing that ultimately and fully satisfied him. Everything he tried, yes, it tasted good for a while, but pretty quickly it became bitter to the mouth. But he eventually worked out something. Something that won't make everything perfect, but a way to navigate life. Why listen to what he found? Well, I think in part because it's not like we as a culture and a country have really worked out how to live the good life, is it? All of the data says we're basically as unhappy as anyone has ever been throughout history. So maybe, just maybe, let's give this teacher a chance today. Let's see what he has to say. Because his answer is going to surprise us. It would surprise anyone. Partly because it challenges the assumption that does the rounds that one of the ways to live the good life is just to focus on the positives. He's not going to do that for us today. But also, I think it will challenge us, particularly those of us who are kind of members of God's people, because it will resist the temptation that Christians often have to just give quite simple answers to life. So you just trust Jesus and it'll all be okay. The teacher resists that kind of mindset. He's going to teach us two things about the good life. Here's the first, seek death's wisdom. Seek death's wisdom. If it's a surprising title, it's because the teacher says it in an incredibly surprising way. Look down with me at chapter 7, verse 1. It starts, a good name is better than fine perfume. If you've spent much time reading the Psalms or Proverbs, kind of if you're used to a kind of Hebrew poetry, you'll know that the way it normally works is the first line is then built on in the second line in quite a similar way. So an Israelite listening to those words would expect it to go something like this. A good name is better than fine perfume, and a great reputation is better than gold. That's kind of how it normally works. That's the rhythm they're expecting. Instead, a good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death is better than the day of birth. Doubly surprising, surprising because of the way in which it comes, but also surprising in what it says. How can the day of death possibly be better than the day of birth? The day of birth is a joyful moment of celebration and happiness. The day of death is a day of sadness and grief. Some of us will hear those words this morning, and they will cut deep because we know what it is to experience the day of death. As we have been there, as loved ones have died. And we think, how can that possibly be better? Our teacher isn't denying the grief of the day of death. We don't deny the grief of death. It's part of the reason we're putting that concert on this evening to help us to reflect on those things. But the reason our teacher says that the day of death is better than the day of birth is because death is a better teacher than birth. Let me show you what I mean in verse 2. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. There's the same idea again. Why? Because death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. Why is the day of death better? Because it reminds us that it's our destiny too. That one day we will all face the day of death. And if we take that to heart, we will be able to live wisely. So the day of death is better because death is a better teacher. One author puts it like this: fools fiddle through a funeral, the wise stare at the coffin. Because as you stare at the coffin, what does it remind you? It reminds you that one day that will be your destiny too. Because death comes to us all. It teaches us that life is not permanent. And that helps us to enjoy life while it's here. Because it reminds us that life is more like a loan. I don't know if you're the kind of person that gets books out of a library, but if you are the kind of person that gets books out of a library and you get the book and you know you've not got it for very long, there are two basic ways to approach that. One is like panic and stress and go, I've only got a short period of time and I need to read it, and you don't end up actually enjoying the book. That is not the right way to deal with a library loan. The better way is to say, I've got this book for a while, I don't quite know how long until someone else recalls it. But I'm going to make the most of it while I have it. I'm going to enjoy it while I can. You make the most of the book while it's yours. So too with life. Life is on loan. We don't know when it's going to be called in. And so we enjoy it while we have it. We give thanks to God that we have it. We make the most of it while we can. And the way we do that is to understand that it is on loan, that it will not last forever, that it's not guaranteed to be ours for as long as we want it. We seek out the house of mourning, because when we seek out the house of mourning, we find what our destiny is. And we take it to heart, and it makes us wise. It enables us to have the good life. What does that look like? What does it look like to seek death's wisdom? To embrace the fact that the day of death is better than the day of birth? Two things we're going to think about today. There's loads more, but here's two. Make the effort to go to funerals. I think that's one thing that our teacher would encourage. As I've been reflecting on this week, I think back to a number of years ago. In the first kind of 3 years or so after I left university, two of my friends from university died of cancer within about 6 months of each other. I didn't know one of them that well. I knew them a bit. The other one I knew really well. We'd been on the same course. We'd been in the same college. We were both Christians, so we were in Christian Union together. I'd lost a touch a little bit since we'd left university. But when the funerals came around, I didn't go to either. Not because I was kind of scared and wanted to avoid it, but it was too far away. I'm too busy. It's too complicated. I just started a new job, and I didn't really know how compassionate leave works, and I didn't want to bother HR. And all the excuses piled up, and I didn't end up going. And to this day, I think I regret that. Why? Because I think that would have done me good. Both in that it's good to be there and be present for those grieving, but also because it would have given me a chance at a relatively young age to take this to heart. That death is the destiny for each of us. So make the effort to go to funerals. Don't go and crash random people's funerals. That would be strange. But don't think, oh, I didn't know them that well. I'm sure they don't really want me there. Wherever there's the opportunity, wherever you can, make the effort to go to funerals. For some of us, it won't actually feel very hard to go to funerals because there's just a relentless run of them at the moment. If we went to every funeral of someone we knew, we'd be going to one every couple of weeks. What would the teacher say to that kind of person, the person in that situation? I think he'd say, resist familiarity stopping you from engaging with what's going on. Sometimes you can go to so many funerals in such quick succession that they just become a kind of thing you get used to. You go through the motions. And I think our teacher would say, let each one teach you. Metaphorically speaking, keep staring at the coffin. Keep engaging with what is going on. For all of us, when we're at a funeral, let's resist the temptation to merely just celebrate the life of the one who is gone. That is part of what we should do. We should celebrate the way that God has used that life and given that life. But there's more than that to be done. We need to let death teach us. Make the effort to go to funerals. Second thing, resist the temptation to just make church all about the positives. The Christian message is good news. It is wonderful good news. And so the tone of church should, generally speaking, be a positive tone, because we have good news to proclaim, good news of God loving the world so much that he sent his son into the world that people who have rebelled against him can have new life. That is wonderful news. It is life-changing news. It is news that should make us shout for joy to the rooftops. But if all we ever do is speak about the positives, I think we miss something of the richness of Scripture. Verse 3, a sad face is good for the heart. It is good to recognize the sadness of life and to let God speak into the sadness of life. Church isn't meant to just be a pep talk and some uplifting music that sends us out inspired for the week. It's much richer than that. It's one of the reasons we preach books like Ecclesiastes that feel quite strange and quite dark at times. Because it's real. It's what life is often like. Don't just enjoy the songs that speak about the positives. Engage with those minor key songs that speak to the reality of life. See, joy is found in seeking death's wisdom. Joy is found in taking to heart the fact that one day all of us face the same destiny. That's what we're called to do. And as we do, we receive life as a loan and we enjoy it while we have it, not knowing when it's going to be called in. That's the first thing. Here's the second and the bigger thing. Know wisdom's limits. Know wisdom's limits. That will help us to live a good life. See, wisdom is a good thing. Our teacher says that, verse 11. Wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing and benefits those who see the sun. That is, wisdom is good for those who are living. It is a helpful thing. And there are a number of ways in this passage that our teacher wants us to know that wisdom is a good thing. Verses 8 to 9, he helps us to see that wisdom will give us patience. Verse 10, he helps us to see that wisdom will give us perspective so we don't constantly ask, why were the old days better than these? That is an unwise way to speak and think, because the old days had its good and its bad, so does this day. The Christian hope is ultimately future, not past. Wisdom gives us patience. Wisdom gives us perspective. Wisdom preserves us, verse 12. It's a shelter like money is a shelter, but the advantage of wisdom is this: it preserves those who have it. Last week we saw just how unstable money is, how it is a shelter for so many people, but it ends up being a risky shelter, a dangerous shelter. Wisdom is not like that. It preserves us. And verse 19, wisdom gives us power. Verse 19, wisdom makes one wise person more powerful than 10 rulers in a city. Wisdom gives us the power to persuade because we are seen as those who understand the world. Wisdom has lots of benefits, the teacher says, but while it has those benefits, it also has significant limits. And that is the teacher's focus in this section. We're going to see three of those limits. Here's the first. Being wise doesn't straighten what's crooked. Being wise doesn't straighten what's crooked. Verse 13. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? I think this is picking up on that idea we've seen again and again in the book, that life is, well, the NIV says, meaningless, hevel, breathy, hard to grasp, hard to make sense of, hard to understand, short, crooked. It just doesn't quite make sense. It's unpredictable and things don't go as exactly as you want them to. And our teacher is saying that God has done that to the world. That's part of the curse that's been on humanity ever since Genesis chapter 3. And because God has done it, we can't solve it. You see, wisdom can teach you to navigate the bent paths. It can give you a compass for when the paths make no sense, but it can't make the paths straight. It can never do that. And it can't guarantee the paths will be easy walking either. It can't straighten what's crooked. And if we believe that wisdom can straighten what's crooked, our lives will be much worse for it. Because when the hard times come, we won't be ready because we'll think, well, I thought I'd prepared to stop this happening. I've done all the right things. Why has this happened? Either I've done something wrong or the world isn't as I expected it to be. And either of those will throw us and stop us living the good life. And so we need to see that wisdom doesn't straighten what's crooked. Crookedness is part of the reality of the world in which we live under the sun. Being wise doesn't straighten what's crooked. Second, being wise doesn't guarantee comprehension. Just because we're wise doesn't mean we will understand everything. There is a real temptation, I think, to think as we know more, as we learn more, we will eventually get to the point where we have a good answer for everything. We will never have a good answer for everything. We will never fully get our heads around everything. The teacher wants us to know that however wise we are, we'll never be able to perfectly understand. Wisdom just doesn't stretch that far, verse 15. However wise we are, it will never make sense to us that the righteous perish in their righteousness and the wicked live long in their wickedness. We instinctively know that's not fair, that's not right. Why is it that good people die young and people who are wicked live long? Why is that fair? How could that be? It won't make sense to us. The Israelite wisdom literature will tell us that generally speaking, living wisely leads to long life and living foolishly leads to short life. And there are times in which that is true, and yet so often it isn't the case. In this crooked world, reality is that sometimes the righteous die in their righteousness and the wicked live long in their wickedness. And we won't fully comprehend that. And so the teacher gives us some pretty strange-sounding advice in verses 16 and 17. I don't know if as we are reading through, you thought, what does that mean? Do not be over-righteous. Neither be over-wise. Why destroy yourself? Don't be over-wicked and don't be a fool. Why die before your time? We kind of want that to say, do be righteous, do be wise, don't be wicked, don't be a fool. That'd be the simple thing to say. So what is the teacher saying to us? I think he is saying, don't think yourself to be really righteous and really wise. Don't think that you've figured it out. Don't think that you've got life and you understand how to live life God's way perfectly. Because if you do, you risk destroying yourself. Don't think that you've cracked life and now you'll sit above its troubles. Because if so, you'll be in for a shock. As I was reflecting on this the other day, I just wonder whether verse 16 is actually a pretty good description of Job's friends. You know, Job's friends, they come along and they think they know how life works. And they end up being rubbish friends to Job. I wonder whether they are an example of people who are over-righteous. They've got all the right answers. They are over-wise. They've always got something to say. And in doing so, they bring destruction. So don't be over-righteous. Don't be over-wise. Don't think that you've cracked life and nailed everything and understand it all fully. Also, don't be over-wicked or wicked at all. Don't be a fool. It doesn't guarantee an early death, but it may well lead to one, and in a number of cases, it does. I think the teacher wants us to understand that we will never fully understand life. One of the things I've been wondering this week is whether that's why some of these verses are just quite hard to get our heads around. Because the verses are written in such a way to remind us that we will never understand life fully. That the way he writes is there to kind of nail the point he's trying to make. It complements the point. He's trying to say life is hard to understand, and he does it by saying things that are hard to understand. He leaves us a bunch of head scratches so that we realize that when it comes to life, there'll be times where we're scratching our heads. See, this teacher, he searched high and low to understand. He made some progress, and yet, verse 24, things were most profound to him, and he wasn't sure how to discover it fully. Being wise will help us to navigate life. It will not explain every detail of life. Being wise doesn't mean life will be like the end of a murder mystery. You know that moment at the end of the murder mystery where the detective or whoever it is that solved it kind of tells you, kind of re-narrates the whole story and tells you how every single detail now makes perfect sense. We will never be able to see life like that because wisdom has its limits. Wisdom is not a kind of hack to ensure our life goes well. Sometimes life will just be hard. And that's not a problem with wisdom, that is the reality of the world. A quote from another author that I found helpful this week. The wisest thing you can do is to realize that not even being wise will tell you everything you want to know. The wisest thing you can do is realize that not even being wise will tell you everything you want to know. Wisdom has its limits. And if we don't understand that, we will run into problems. We will feel like we always need to be able to give an answer, and if we can't give an answer, if we can't explain why something's happening, then somehow there must be something wrong with us or wrong with God's word. But no, we don't need to despair when sometimes we are just baffled by life, where we still have some things to say, but we can't fully explain it because wisdom has its limits. We won't be able to fully comprehend life. And third thing, being wise doesn't solve our ultimate problem. Being wise doesn't solve our ultimate problem. This passage, probably more than any other in Ecclesiastes, it brings to the surface that problem. That problem is there for us in verse 20. Look down at verse 20. There is no one on earth who is righteous. No one who does what is right and never sins. As the teacher looks around the world, he sees that there is no one righteous. No one who does everything right. No one who never sins. The teacher includes himself in that verse. The teacher includes all of us in that verse. That is not something we can learn our way out of. We will never fully be righteous. It is the fundamental human problem that wisdom cannot solve. This is the ultimate reason why the world is crooked, why the world is hard to grasp, why the good life feels so elusive, because we've cut ourselves off from the source of all goodness. It's something the teacher knows from first-hand experience. I think that's what's going on in verse 28. Verse 28 is tricky to understand. While I was searching but not finding, I found one upright man among a thousand, but not one upright woman among them all. Is the teacher just sexist? It's the obvious question we're all asking, isn't it? First thing to say, it is very hard to translate this sentence, but the word upright isn't actually there in the original. I know why they've done it, and it might be legitimate, but I don't think it's actually helped us this time. Here's how the ESV puts it. One man among a thousand I have found, but not one woman among a thousand. The word upright isn't there. I think that helps us because I think what is going on is the teacher, whoever he is, has searched for wise people, and his personal experience, having kind of met a thousand people, is that one of them is right, is wise, is faithful, and that happens to be a man. He is not saying this is like a general truism that men are somehow, by a factor of one in a thousand, more likely to be righteous than women. I just don't think that's what's going on. I think he is saying that when he searches it out, there's almost no one who ends up being a faithful, trustworthy friend. He doesn't find nearly anyone, just one. And why is that? Because of verse 29. Verse 29. This only have I found. God created mankind upright, but they have gone in search of many schemes. In many ways, in one verse, that is the most compact summary of Genesis 1-3 that I think the Bible gives us. God created mankind upright, literally God created Adam upright, but they have gone in search of many schemes. We were made good in the beginning, and then we have run astray, like a rebellious child running away from our Maker. And this, says the teacher, is the fundamental human problem. It is a problem that cannot be solved by being wise. The problem is too widespread. Everyone's impacted. The problem is too deeply ingrained. It affects every area of our lives. And it's why I'm so glad the Bible doesn't end with Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is, roughly speaking, in the middle of the Bible. There is a whole load of the Bible left to come after this, and most significantly, there is one person left to come who hasn't come by the end of Ecclesiastes. There is one person who comes who doesn't fit verse 20. Verse 20, there is no one on earth who is righteous, no one who does what is right and never sins, except there was later one on earth who was righteous. One later on earth who did what was right and never sinned. One who was truly that one among a thousand. And his name was Jesus. And here's how Paul speaks of him in 1 Corinthians. Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God. That is our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. Here is true wisdom from God. Here is the one who is not constrained by wisdom's limits. Because he is God, so he can straighten what's being made crooked. He is God, so he does comprehend all things. The world is no mystery to him. And he is the one who solves our ultimate problem. And he does it by becoming our righteousness. How does that work? Elsewhere in the Bible, we're told that the one who had no sin became sin so that in him we could become the righteousness of God. If you were here last week, you'd have seen it as we were thinking together with the children. What does Jesus do for us? He makes us right in God's sight. There were two people up here with white t-shirts. One of them had all kinds of sins written all over them. And what happens is we swap t-shirts. Jesus takes on himself our unrighteousness so that he can be our righteousness. He gives his righteousness to us. We can be declared right in God's sight, utterly perfect before God, not because of anything we have done. Chapter 7, verse 2 said that death is the destiny of everyone. Death didn't need to be his destiny. He need not have faced it. He didn't deserve it. He did nothing that meant he should die. And yet he chose death as a destiny. And he did it so that in him we would have righteousness and holiness and redemption. He is the true one among a thousand. The one who does what is right and never sins. And he did that for us. He is the one that answers the greatest problem. The thing that wisdom cannot solve, true wisdom from God does come and solve it. So if you're here and you're trusting in him, life will still feel frustrating at times. Life will still feel weighed down by its crookedness. We will still be baffled at times by why life is going the way that it is. In this life under the sun, until Jesus returns to make everything right, life will feel baffling, it will feel crooked. We will feel downcast to the way that we fall short of how we desire to live. And in all of those things, we look to Christ, because he is our wisdom from God, not himself subject to wisdom's limits. He is our righteousness, our holiness, and our redemption. As we look to him, we find everything we need to navigate this life well. And if you're here this morning and you're looking in on these things, and you feel the frustration of the world, you feel the frustration at the way the world itself seems like a mess. You feel frustrated by the unpredictability of the world in which you live. You feel frustrated by the way you contribute to the mess of the world. Let me hold out to you the one in whom answers are found. He won't make life easy, but he will make it good, because he himself is utter goodness. And in him comes righteousness, holiness, and redemption. If we put our trust in him. So as we close, how do we live the good life? The teacher has shown us two key elements. Know we will die, and know the limits of what wisdom can do. Because as we learn both of these, we will begin to see that life is a loan. Life is a gift. It can be recalled at any moment, but we can enjoy it while it's here. And we'll know that we'll never master life, and that's okay. Because there is one who has, and he has become our wisdom and our righteousness. He is all we ever need. Let me lead us in prayer, giving thanks for him. Our Father in heaven, we praise you for Jesus. We thank you for him, our wisdom from you, our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. We praise you that everything we need is in him, that if we have him, we have all we need for this life. And we pray these things in his name. Amen.